I have not directed anyone not to obey a subpoena. I have advised them of their options.
A new round of No Shows and lawmakers' Troopergate investigation. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, the 26th of September. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Democrats revive an old ballot measure idea.
I think that this is very much a leverage point to help the producers decide to commit gas to a gas pipeline.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. You can prevent costly damage to the environment with an inspection of heating equipment and fuel oil tanks. Spills can contaminate drinking water and stormwater drains, which can cause health problems for people and animals. Technical assistance is available online at dec.state.ak.us. Click on the Spill Prevention and Response link for assistance to the Home Heating Oil webpage. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation.
For the second week in a row, witnesses who had been subpoenaed to report to the Senate Judiciary Committee did not show up. They were expected to testify in the legislature's investigation of the firing of former Public Safety Commissioner Walt Monaghan, much the same as last week when the first six witnesses were no-shows. Senator Hollis French gave a brief written statement to reporters naming the seven state employees who ignored the subpoenas today.
The subpoenas that had not been served as of last Friday, September 19, 2008, were for Ms. Diane Kiesel, Ms. Annette Kreitzer, Ms. Nikki Neal, Mr. Brad Thompson, Mr. Michael Nysick, Ms. Chris Perry, and Ms. Janice Mason.
French said legislators may find that the 13 witnesses are now in contempt. A lawsuit filed yesterday by Attorney General Talis Kohlberg against French, Senate President Lyda Green, the Judiciary Committee, and the subpoenas was followed by a letter to the committee asking them to stop work and wait for a response by the court.
Let me remind the department and the public that this investigation began nearly 2 months ago. The administration and the Department of Law have repeatedly promised cooperation with this inquiry, both orally and in writing. Indeed, we are here today because of Attorney General Kohlberg's abrupt and complete change in position. On July 29, 2008, the Legislative Council Committee gave me a job to do. That committee and the Judiciary Committees of both bodies are engaged in a simple search for the truth. We intend to keep pursuing that goal.
French exited the room immediately after his written comments, taking no questions. Senate Minority Leader Jean Theriault is a member of the Judiciary Committee. Theriault stepped to the podium, saying he thinks the Legislative Council's investigation has become too partisan.
This process appears to have been politicized, and it seems like we should let that other process work. In fact, that other process is moving forward, despite what the legislature does or doesn't do.
The other process is the Personnel Board. The Personnel Board is comprised of three governor-appointed members, and the proceedings are completely confidential. Theriault said he's been contacted twice by McCain's people, but he said he told them he would only discuss process. Fairbanks Republican Representative Jay Ramirez says the breakdown in cooperation with the legislature's investigation is causing a fracture within Alaska. Ramirez says he is concerned about Attorney General Kohlberg's behavior, saying that when Kohlberg was confirmed, the legislature held him over for a second day of questioning because of concerns over his depth of legal experience.
Some of those concerns are beginning to show themselves. The notion that he advised members of the administration to ignore subpoenas and then moved at a much later date to quash the subpoenas and is not doing that with any kind of urgency, whatever the legal word is for that. I'm a layperson. I think is of concern.
All seven of the witnesses who ignored subpoenas today are named as plaintiffs in the lawsuit. Kohlberg held a press conference to answer questions about why the lawsuit was filed. He also sought to correct a misunderstanding regarding Governor Palin's attorney, Thomas Van Flein. Kohlberg says Van Flein is on contract with the state to represent the governor, despite Van Flein's comments last week to the contrary. Van Flein is also representing the governor's husband, Todd Palin, who refused to appear after he was subpoenaed in the Monaghan firing investigation. When pressed about whether the dual representation would be a conflict, Kohlberg answered this way.
I don't want to say that I have no concern about things. I really don't have all the possible parameters of what that question might lead to. I would say that there are all kinds of issues that come up in this circumstance that probably haven't been anticipated by a lot of folks, but we have tried to make it clear that he is the attorney under the contract for the governor, and the reason for that started before there ever was a McCain campaign.
Kohlberg says he did not advise witnesses to ignore subpoenas.
I have not directed anyone not to obey a subpoena. I have advised them of their options, and we have advised people that we believe these are not standard subpoenas. And as the lawsuit lays out, we believe there are five examples of why these subpoenas are infirm. And if they were a normal subpoena, we do not believe they would be optional.
Kohlberg says he did not ask for an injunction against the legislature's investigation because he doesn't see a need for urgency in the court's decision. VECO employees testified today in the trial of Senator Ted Stevens that they spent hundreds of hours working on his Girdwood home. A bookkeeper with the company also testified that she was instructed not to keep a paper trail on expenses in Girdwood. The government is building its case in federal court that Senator Stevens took hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of gifts, including the house renovation, and didn't report them on his Senate financial disclosure forms. APRN reporter Libby Casey is covering the trial and joins us from Washington. Hi, Libby.
Hi, Lori.
Libby, it sounds like there were quite a few witnesses for the prosecution today. What details did they give?
Six out of the seven witnesses who've testified so far today and yesterday worked for VECO, and all but one of them worked at Stevens' Girdwood home. Witnesses pointed out in photos of his house the exact work they did. One of them is Roy Detmer, who lives in Colorado, and he said over about 4 months, starting in the year 2000, he wired the Stevens' house, installed phone lines and outside lighting fixtures. Now, here's how he got paid to work at the house. He would clock in at a VECO job site in the port of Anchorage and then drive 45 minutes south to Girdwood to work on the Stevens house. At the end of the day, he'd drive all the way back to the port to clock back out again. He told the court he worked 10 hours a day, 6 days a week. Other men testified about work they did at the house in 1999 and 2000. And yesterday we heard from a VECO employee who designed the plans for Stevens house.
Libby, did any of the VECO workers see Stevens out at the job site?
Well, the employee who designed the house had a lunch with Stevens to talk about the project, but none of the other men ever saw the senator out at the house, although one of them did see his wife, Catherine.
The Stevens couple did pay some bills on the house, but not to VECO.
That's right. They paid about $160,000 to Christensen Builders of Anchorage. The prosecutors say that was just for part of the work on the house. One of the Christensen Builders employees testified today. Mike Luther talked about how he saw a lot of VECO employees on the job site and answered to one of them who was acting as the foreman. One piece of evidence was a punch list, and that's a list of work remaining on a project. Luther had jotted the list down on VECO stationery that he just found lying around, and it was one of those visual images that the prosecution is using to try and give the picture that VECO was all over the project.
And what about the bookkeeper who was told not to leave a paper trail about the expenses out at Girdwood?
Well, Cheryl Boomershine was in accounting at the company, and one of the government prosecutors had her explain a lot of the VECO paperwork, like receipts and invoices. The prosecutor pointed out wages on the books of people who worked in Girdwood, which had its own code. And the prosecutor asked, well, did VECO have any oil field service projects in Girdwood? And Boomershine said, no. Also, the only checks from Stevens to VECO during that period were reimbursements for chartered trips. There were no checks paying for the work on the Girdwood house. The most interesting piece of evidence was a handwritten note on the back of, like, an expense sheet. Boomershine had written, what is this and why? And the answer she got back from a colleague in writing was Girdwood and no paper trail per Bill Allen. Now, he was VECO's CEO and in charge of the company.
How did the defense team respond to that?
They pointed out that the person who signed off on all the invoices and other Girdwood expenses was Allen, that it was his responsibility. And they're setting up an argument that it was Bill Allen who was manipulative and in charge of the paperwork and the bills.
Libby, is there any word on when we'll hear from Bill Allen?
Well, we found out this evening that it looks like Monday. The government said tonight that they would call him as a witness when court resumes next week. He's expected to be central to their case, and we anticipate hearing wiretapped conversations between Allen and Senator Stevens. We had some fireworks in the courtroom today, Lori, not in front of the jury and not involving Stevens, but from the judge directed to the prosecutors. The case is moving along faster than the government apparently predicted, so they're scrambling to get witnesses here from Alaska and other places. And the judge is usually very even-keeled, but he was angry tonight and admonished them about wasting people's time. And he said if the government wasn't prepared to call more witnesses, there may be no more witnesses and their case could be over. Well, they were able to juggle flights and people's schedules and said they will be ready next week. And they are already prepared to call Bill Allen. The defense, on the other hand, had hoped for a delay in calling Allen as a witness because they're still trying to get a hold of his medical records about a motorcycle accident that damaged part of his brain back in 2001. It left him with, like, a speech problem, and the defense team wants experts to look at his medical records and see if they can argue that his cognitive abilities are compromised.
Libby, Alaska is, of course, at the heart of this case, but it's so far from Washington. How has that been for jurors to grasp?
Well, there's a lot of explaining of things that would be basic to an Alaskan jury, you know, about the importance of generators and about car plug-ins and the geography of the state. And there are also a lot of explanations about construction work terms. And you see how language comes into play in the court. And just talking about Girdwood is kind of loaded. You know, the prosecution calls it a ski town and refers to Stevens' house as the chalet, which is what he called it at times. The defense told jurors that, first of all, no, the house was a modest A-frame and that Girdwood is nothing like a ritzy ski town like Aspen. Instead, they described it more as a small neighborly community where the roads aren't even paved. So they're both painting very different pictures in the jurors' minds.
All right, Libby, thank you for that update.
Thanks a lot, Lori.
APRN's Libby Casey reporting from Washington, D.C. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, concern for a rare Alaskan bird.
What really kind of impacted overall nesting success was loss due to exposure or starvation.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo. Manage accounts, pay bills, and get instant loan decisions online at wellsfargo.com. The next stage. And by
Grant Station, finding grants for nonprofit organizations, schools, and governmental agencies throughout the U.S. and Canada. Grant Station, fast track to funding. On the web at grantstation.com.
One of the most contentious ballot questions of 2 years ago, the tax on North Slope natural gas that is not offered for production, is back before the public. The so-called reserves tax failed on a nearly 2-to-1 margin following a major campaign against it by the oil industry and headed by then-Governor Frank Murkowski. But the paperwork for a new initiative was filed today by three legislative Democrats, Harry Crawford, David Guttenberg, and Beth Kurtula. Crawford says the goal of the initiative is not to raise money for the state, it's to help get gas on the way to market. He says if it gets the initial public support, it will be on the ballot in 2010, shortly after gas leaseholders have a chance to commit to using a suitable gas line. And tax of 3 cents per 1,000 cubic feet of proven reserves will go into effect on all North Slope gas that's withheld from the project.
I think that this is very much a leverage point to help the producers decide what might be in their best interest to commit gas to a gas pipeline that has the 20 must-haves that the governor and the legislature decided were must-haves for a project here in Alaska.
Crawford says having the tax on the ballot immediately after commitments are due will give the public a chance to show approval or disapproval of the leaseholder's response. He says the state would give the money back to the companies when they produce gas.
Completely refundable. We took the time limit out this time so that they get all their money back when they get the gas to market. But we get to hold on to it between the time that the tax goes into effect and gas first flows.
Crawford says the tax would raise about $600 million from older known oil reserves on the slope, not from any new exploration. The state ferry system plans to build a new ship that could sail at either end of Southeast. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
What's being called the Southeast Shuttle would be designed to serve Lynn Canal, as well as the Ketchikan to Prince Rupert route. The system had considered and begun designing separate ships for the two routes, but Marine Highway General Manager John Falvey says a single design would provide flexibility so the ship could sail where it's needed. Falvey told the recent Southeast Conference annual meeting that a final design has yet to be worked out, but the basic requirements have been set.
This concept that we have is a vessel that be a little over 300 feet long, minimum of 60 large Alaska vehicles, standard vehicle, 500 passengers. It would need to have the ability to operate in Lynn Canal and Dixon Entrance year-round with 99% reliability.
The shuttle would include crew quarters. That's so it could carry enough staff to handle the 15-hour round-trip Ketchikan-Rupert run without violating work rules, but it would not have passenger staterooms. Falvey says the initial use would be in Lynn Canal. It could replace the Malaspina on its Skagway, Haines, and Juneau sailings, or it could sail from the end of a new road out of Juneau if it's built. But it or its twin could also serve on the southern route, or it could handle village service out of Juneau.
We would ultimately see 2 to 3 of these. Very efficient, very fuel efficient, very automated, reduced crew, and efficient to run, and capable of running in just about any kind of weather conditions that we would encounter here in Southeast.
He says having the same design would make the shuttles interchangeable. They could fill in for each other during breakdowns, maintenance, and overhauls. The Marine Highway has $60 million toward what is expected to be an $80 million ferry. Falvey says the State Department of Transportation will ask for the remaining $20 million in the next capital budget cycle. He estimates it will take about 4 years to design and build. Marine Transportation Advisory Board Chairwoman Kathy Romick says the shuttle scenario makes sense.
The future plan is to have more of the day boat type vessel because that's the most, they're economically more efficient to do the day boat runs. And I'd like to see, more than one of these boats ordered because when you order more than one, you get a significant discount.
She says the shuttles will likely replace aging vessels in the system's 11-ship fleet. Plans will go up for public discussion before the design is completed. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from Juneau.
Yesterday, a transportation fair in Palmer provided information for the public on a wide variety of plans to get people in the Mat-Su Valley moving faster from one place to another. Tom Middendorf is working on a 20-year plan for the Palmer Airport. He says plans for growth include expanded maintenance facilities in Palmer, something that Hagland Air is already working on.
They operate from Anchorage, and then they come to Palmer, and they do all their maintenance of those airplanes here in Palmer, even though the planes fly in and out of Anchorage.
For those that ride the local Mat-Su community transit buses, change will come a bit more quickly, according to Lou Friend, who heads Mascot. He says passengers to the north and west of Wasilla will get regular routes for the first time, among other innovations.
Well, we're excited here, October 6th. We're going to be changing routes and times. We're going to be offering express routes earlier in the morning, which we have not been able to do, to help folks, as it were, commute back and forth in the valley.
Mascot also runs commuter buses to Anchorage, although some commuters are looking forward to riding the rails to the big city. Tom Brooks with the Alaska Railroad says commuter service is still a ways away, but the railroad is working toward it little by little.
Well, I think the railroad's done a number of projects to kind of enable commuter service. We've put some track straightening projects in place and built a bunch of depots. I think the next step is going on right now where the Mat-Su Borough and the City of Anchorage are getting together and talking about forming a joint regional transportation authority.
Brooks says most tracks between Wasilla and Anchorage are already built and upgraded.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
9 out of 10 of Alaska's boating fatalities are adult males. Most drowned following an unexpected fall or capsize into cold water. Cold water can kill the unprepared, regardless of swimming ability. Wearing a life jacket can make the difference between life and death. Make your family's boating memories good ones. Always wear a life jacket when boating Alaska's cold water. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
This week on AK, we ponder Alaska's ethics. Why have we been plagued with scandals here? Plus, developing farmland and balancing human safety with the presence of bears. That and more this week on AK from APRN.
Fluctuations in seabird populations are often seen as indicators of environmental change. That's why some scientists are worried about high chick mortality and significant population decline in a rare Alaskan bird, the Kittlitz murrelet. KIAL's Ann Hillman has more.
Fish and wildlife biologist Rob Kaler says when he first found a Kittlitz murrelet on a nest in Agatu Island in the Western Aleutians back in 2005, it was only the 24th nest ever found in the world. The rare birds range from eastern Russia to southeast Asia and often live on glaciers. Kaler describes the small brown bird's breeding habits and nesting habits as cryptic.
So this bird has really evolved a system of probably predator avoidance during the breeding season. They nest inland solitarily, whereas most other alcids nest in larger colonies. And these birds are dispersed. You know, you find one nest, and that's you won't find another one for a fair distance.
This summer, Kaler searched and found 17 nests on the island. It gave him and his partner the rare opportunity to research breeding habits and reproductive success. He found that in the 17 nests, only one chick survived.
What really kind of impacted overall nesting success was loss due to exposure or starvation. We can't exactly say one or the other, but we know that we found, you know, chicks dead in the nest scrapes.
Kaler says it's not just Aleutian populations that are suffering. Population counts of the murrelet on waters throughout Alaska show an 80% decline. The current population is only about 10 to 20,000 birds. He says no one is exactly sure why.
Perhaps oil spill mortality or gill net mortality, as well as changes in the climate, which might be influencing their diet, you know, their forage fish diet, as well as the loss of glaciers and glacial recession for their nesting habitat.
He says it's hard to know without more in-depth research, but he thinks it's something people need to consider.
You know, everybody talks about using indicators of, you know, environmental health, and this, you know, this bird can represent, you know, what's going on. Its association with glaciers, particularly in southeast Alaska, you know, when these birds begin disappearing, you know, it's kind of setting up the stage for maybe something more profound is going on.
Scientists have unsuccessfully tried to get the Kittlitz murrelet listed as threatened or endangered for the last 2 years. In Unalaska, I'm Ann Hillman.
Last night, the Public Safety Committee of the Anchorage Assembly held a special meeting to examine the recent bear problems in the city. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
After years of dealing with Anchorage's bears, Rick Sinnott offered the following appraisal.
Our perception of risk can be much higher than the real risk.
Sinnott is an area wildlife biologist with the State Department of Fish and Game. His area is Anchorage. He was asked to give a historical as well as a current description of the bear situation.
9 people have been injured and 2 killed by brown bears in the Anchorage area since the city was founded. 5 people have been injured by black bears, but these were all scratches or single bites. All of these were surprise encounters.
Last night's meeting followed a summer that saw 2 bear maulings within the Anchorage Bowl and another Eagle River attack resulting in injuries. The Anchorage School District has stopped cross-country training in the Hilltop ski area. And on Wednesday, the Alaska Botanical Gardens announced a 2-week closure due to the continuing presence of a bear. All the same, Sinnott says records show Anchorage residents have a greater chance of being injured by a moose than a bear. He says encounter problems are more often caused by people than bears. While Fish and Game have direct oversight of the bears, he listed 3 ways the city could help. Enforce trash regulations designed to thwart garbage-seeking bears. Stop building trails next to salmon streams. And restrict future development to avoid problems with bears. He noted a survey taken 12 years ago indicated Anchorage residents balked at killing the bears for population reduction. They enjoyed sharing their city with moose and bears.
Last night's comments indicated that enjoyment may have lessened over the last dozen years. Michael Banya is a lifelong Anchorage resident who says the bear situation in Bicentennial Park has changed for the worse.
Lately, I've been creeped out when I go up there. So what I've done is I carry a .44 Magnum with me now when I'm on my bicycle. I am not going to give up these trails to the bear.
Rick Rogers is a biker who escaped a menacing bear encounter early this summer, not far from the Hilltop parking lot. He saw part of the city's bear problem arising from overall fish and game policies.
A brown bear was just hit in traffic right next to, Cal Worthington Ford, and now we're going to put salmon into Chester Creek, and we're going to draw that brown bear problem right into the heart of the city.
Those who backed reducing the bear population through killing were balanced against those who argued for more public education, development practices acknowledging wildlife, and even hiring a municipal wildlife specialist. Gillette Storm is president of the Friends of Campbell Creek Science Center and a former Bureau of Land Management employee at the Campbell Tract. She said her experiences with bears supported coexistence. However, Storm said this summer's nighttime attack on the young girl participating in a biking event raised questions about the city's responsibility.
We have to do better risk management. I really have to ask where the municipality was when they allowed a 24-hour race.
Assemblymember Bill Starr said that Anchorage might have to acknowledge that the city's growth had created a new relationship with its wildlife, especially bears.
You know, 85,000, 100,000 people is a lot different than we're approaching 300,000.
Starr said along with supporting more data collection, he plans to introduce a resolution urging that Fish and Game allow the city to participate more actively in the department's policy decisions regarding Anchorage. This is Len Anderson.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Ann Hillman in Unalaska, and Len Anderson in Anchorage. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., Dave Donaldson from Juneau, and Ellen Lockyer from Palmer. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. John Prophet is our webmaster. Our managing editor is Duncan Moon. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the University of Alaska, the home of award-winning faculty, students, and alumni, and offering 500 different degrees and certificates. Find one that's right and do something major. Information at alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska. Lack of maintenance is the primary reason heating oil tanks contaminate drinking water, sewers, and stormwater drains. Homeowners are liable under state law for the cleanup of spills from home heating oil tanks on their property. So prevent spills by arranging an inspection of tanks and heating equipment before and during the heating season. Information online at dec.state.ak.us. Click on the Spill Prevention and Response link. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. The Division of Elections reminds voters that Tuesday, November 4th, is Election Day. Polling places will be open from 7 a.m. until 8 p.m. To find your polling place, call 1-888-383-8683. If you need language or other assistance while voting, you may ask the election board or bring a person of your choice to assist you. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska Division of Elections.
APRN will be providing special coverage of the 50th anniversary of Alaska statehood. For sponsorship information, call 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.